It must be Thursday. Welcome to Learning Unwrapped, the talk show about your most important life skill. I'm very excited today to be talking about mathematics, the global language. So let's get right to it with first a huge thank you to International Broadcast Media TV. You can get there by ibmtv.tv. You can watch the show there. You can watch past shows there. And you can watch a million other good shows. I was just on a show this week on Monday. It was called Economics Monday, but they were talking about higher education and how we can build or how we need to build financial fitness in students K-12. So that was fun, and I was on that show. So definitely an awesome network. You've got to go and check out all the shows. So, but let's get back to this show. I'm going to bring in my co-host, who is a woman that I've worked with for a number of years now, a former middle school math teacher who is now our IDE Corps Director of Client Relations, Nicole Koch.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Nance.
Good to see you. I love the sign.
Good to see you.
I love the sign you always have behind you. Golden cross on.
So that is my motto.
We've got some, and you do it too. So we've got some really cool guests. So let's get them on so we can start this great conversation. Our first guest, I actually found on LinkedIn and then got talking with her. Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez is a professor of curriculum instruction at Illinois University College of Education. In her former days, not too former, I imagine, she was a Fulbright scholar. She focuses on issues of identity and power in mathematics education and the need to rehumanize mathematics. She also builds upon indigenous principles and has argued for a new form of mathematics where humans are no longer centered. So, Rochelle, you know, I'm going to be asking about this form of mathematics referred to as living mathematics. She is the editor of a collection of research. I have that over here. A collection of research studies. I never do this part right. Called Rehumanizing Mathematics for Black, Indigenous, and Latinx Students, which is published through NCTM, the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics. Please welcome Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez. Hi.
Hi, Rochelle.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good to see you.
It's good to see you.
Thanks for being here.
So, Rochelle, I'm just going to ask you, what's one thing that you learned this week?
So one thing I learned, maybe a lot of people are starting to get interested in murmurations of starlings, you know, people who take those photographs of the starling formations, the birds that are all kind of in swarms almost over, often they're in Denmark and Sweden that those pictures are being taken from, and they look really beautiful. And I think one of the things that I learned was that the only way that photographers can actually capture this is when those starlings are being under attack. So it's when they have predators. So when we look at these images and we're thinking, oh, how beautiful, look at the way they're dancing. Look at the, we also have to say like, and look at how resilient, you know, that all together as a pack, they're learning how to avoid this predator. They're learning how to create holes. They're learning how to dodge things. They're learning how to. So I thought that was really interesting because I think I had only really thought about the beauty of it and hadn't thought about the resilience.
That is very cool. You know, I often hear about that. I live by the beach and you'll see fish jumping out of water. And I remember when I first got here and I'm like, look at the fish jumping. That is so cute. And it's like, cute. That usually means there's a shark behind me. Oh, hadn't thought about that. Well, Rochelle, it's great having you here. And I look forward to discussing some of these, you know, interesting facets from the book. So let's get in. We have two math teachers who are going to be working with us. So Rochelle, you're out in Illinois. We're now going to head over to South Carolina, where, for those of you who know our Director of Educational Equity, Shanae Buford, the next guest is a colleague of hers. They used to teach math together. Kimberly Jeter is a lead teacher at the School of Zoological and Botanical Studies Magnet Program. I love that. At Longleaf Middle School in Richland School District 2, Columbia, South Carolina. She is a lover of middle school mathematicas and, quote, all of the stress, drama, and greatness it encompasses. Love that one. She's presented her work and served as session facilitator at national conferences, including ASCD, Association of Supervision and Curriculum Development, and AMLE, the Association for Middle Level Educators. Never thought that was that hard to say. She is also a rotating adjunct professor at Columbia College in the College of Education. Please welcome Kimberly Jeter.
Good evening. I'm so excited to be here. How is everyone?
Great, great.
Good. Very good. Thank you, Kimberly. Yeah. So I'm going to throw it your way and ask you, what is one thing you learned this week?
Well, I definitely learned, or I guess it was almost, you know, sometimes you're in this constant stream of learning and then something just clicks, almost like when you have your students. And definitely this week, the difference between being ready and being prepared and understanding that process. We can say mentally, like, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to do this. And then you get an email from Nancy Sulla, and then you're like, wait a minute, am I prepared? And then you're like, no, I am prepared. So I'm excited to be here. So I definitely love when readiness and preparedness come together. So I'm excited for this evening. So I can't wait to learn and grow and hopefully make some connections and just bring it back to my program that I lead.
That's awesome. Wonderful. And mm-hmm. I love that readiness and preparedness come together.
Yeah, such a great growth mindset.
We're going to find out if our next guest is ready and prepared, because he's coming to us from Thailand, where it is 5 o'clock in the morning. Everyone in his family, including the dog, is still asleep. Manish Verma is a math teacher at Concordian International School in Bangkok, Thailand. He is also an international baccalaureate examiner for IB schools. He focuses on inquiry-based learning in math. He's the former head of the math department at the Canadian International School in Beijing and a former IB teacher and examiner in Singapore. So while he hails from India, he then went overseas, as he calls it. It's very funny being in America. It's a different sea. He loves to hike, and I love this. He climbed to an altitude of 4,000 meters, the Tibet Mountains from the China side. And that is actually 13,000 feet for those of you in the United States, which is like, I get nauseous when I'm at 3,000 feet. So I don't know how he did it, but please welcome Manish Verma.
Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
And I'm excited to talk, share, and learn from all of you. And it is, yeah, actually 5 a.m. over here. My kids and wife, all of them are sleeping. And I'm here to talk with you and excited to learn.
Wonderful.
Yes, how are you? Everyone, tell me.
Thank you, Manish. Yeah, I'm doing well. Thank you. It's later on my side, so I'm drinking my coffee to get through the rest of the day. So I'm going to ask you, what's one thing you learned this week?
One thing that this year, this week we came to, we back to school with the student face-to-face classes. And I asked my students that, oh, did you like online or you are liking these face-to-face classes? So they were divided on this topic, and they say some good thing about online and some good thing about face-to-face learning. Mm-hmm. So I learned that both has their own importance, like, you know, on some areas they have like important thing into that. And last week I tried to grill a fish, a complete fish. I never did before. So this time I tried at my home. Mm-hmm. And I bought gas grill and I grilled fish. Oh. And I love that. Yes. So spicy Indian spices and all. And I use that. I learned this week, these two things.
Now you're making me hungry over here.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And Manish, you can see that a lot of our live audience is waking you up with good morning messages.
So, morning, everyone.
It's a wonderful thing. So you are all obviously lovers of math, and Nicole is a former math teacher. I'm a former math teacher. So what a good group to start this conversation with. The reason I selected the title was because once upon a time, not too long ago, I wrote this awesome book. It is one of my favorite books, but people don't read it. And I'll tell you why. If you look at that title there, I was asked by my publisher to write a book about the Common Core state standards when they came out in the United States. And I really wanted to wrap my head around it. So what I did was I really learned about the standards and thought about them. And I thought, I don't want to write a book that simply is here's how to read the ELA standards and here's how to read the math standards. So I developed 7 insights, which I think are really cool insights into the Common Core. Well, by the time I worked through this, fleshed it out, wrote the book, rewrote the book, figured it out, and had the book published, Common Core state standards was a dirty word in the United States. And people were like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. So here's a good book that you'll never read. And One of the insights actually started out that math is a global language. And I think that, you know, you often hear, particularly girls, little girls will say, I'm not good at math. And then their parents will say, oh, I was never good at math either. And there's this whole idea that math is very hard. And when I was a math teacher, I was working with low-level children, and I said, let's think of math as a language. Let's have a conversation in math. And I had them all bring in a picture, and it was either a picture of something in their house or something they pulled out of a magazine, or these were middle school students, or a painting, famous painting, whatever. And then I said, describe it only using math. So we're going to make measurements. We're going to measure angles. We're going to use geometry. And they had such fun. And I think it really made math more accessible. It was like, well, this isn't that hard, is it? And it's like, no, related to the real world, because math is a global language, you know, two is two all over the place. So let's talk about that. How do you see that math is more accessible than people even think? What are your thoughts?
I'll jump in. I think about this a lot because I think about, you know, part of the work that I've done in talking to adolescents and to teachers and to community members is listening to the dehumanization that people have experienced, the trauma that they've experienced in schools, and feeling like, you say, like math is not accessible. But when we think about it, you know, we are all mathematical. We were all born mathematical. And it's really not until we get into school that school teaches us you're only mathematical if you do mathematics in these very particular ways. If you show your work using these algorithms, if you, you know, if the way that you are presenting your information is part of the school learning objectives, right? And it's not that there are things that you know in your heart that you have intuition about, that your body and your senses are all being brought forward to do mathematics. We all do that in our lives outside of school. So it's really, I think I agree with you that it is this universal language, but then school mathematics kind of reduces that into something that says only certain people can speak it.
Actually, I agree with Rachel, like what she's saying, like in school, it looks different, like, you know, different mathematics. And we talk to make it available for common people, those who are not actually directly in contact with maths or they are doing math. So we nowadays working, like I believe in inquiry-based learning. So I took a student, suppose I'm teaching quadratic equation, how will I make them connected with their life and understand, and they don't feel isolated from the mathematics. So I took them to the garden nearby in school and outside learning. And then I will ask them, like, okay, why nature has like this kind of shape? So see the trees. All the trees have like, can be modeled as a quadratic equation. So, or some curve, some sort of curve, so they can draw a curve, they try to sketch on paper. So what is happening? We are transferring natural things or the thing which is in nature on the paper as mathematics. So we are actually transferring the knowledge and applying it. So they will find out why this tree has this shape, mathematical, and what kind of mathematics I will write for this to transfer knowledge, my knowledge to other people or in other areas of sciences or math.
And I know, Manish, you take a very inquiry-based approach to mathematics.
Yes.
Send students into the real world to see what problems can we solve.
Right. So actually, rather than instructing them, this is math, they find out what is math. That's what we believe. So inverted method is going on, and they like it. They try to engage themselves into it. They like it, definitely, in inquiry-based learning.
And I feel like it's so important when we think of math as a language. I'm blessed to have three little ones. So I get to experience not only things as a teacher, but as a mom and watching them grow.
And then the next one grow.
They keep growing. But when we expose, you know, young children to just language in general, they see it, they hear it, they taste it, right? But when it comes to math and we put them into a classroom, that it's like math just becomes numbers. And I feel like, and then more, the older they get, that language is literally just stuck to numbers. But what happens to matching that number with pictures, right? At the simplest form. And that's what really brings it to life and transforms it into a true language and helps students understand that language. And I think that's so powerful. My daughter right now is struggling with math a little bit, and we just keep trying to give her more the number line. And now she's like, Mom, I just need that little number line and I can do it, you know? And I think that's so powerful, is just making sure that that language doesn't get lost, encompassing all of those pieces.
Yeah. And I agree. I think the common thread that I think I hear everyone saying is that connection to the math and knowing that you can do it. And right along with that, that confidence piece. I remember when my nephew was small and I would see my sister just feeding them like little Cheerios, and they're counting and they're doing this thing and everything is great. Everything's fun then when you're counting Cheerios. And it's like, well, there's the math, you know, there's no difference. But I think when we get into school-based math, it's fit into this little box. We want to put math in a box, and it's so not. It's one of the best lessons I think I ever taught was doing the dab, but using the Pythagorean theorem to see who had the best dab. And I literally was going through Twitter and I'm like, I can do this with my kids. My kids, even the kids that can't even say Pythagorean theorem, can do this. So mm-hmm. we go outside, we had teacher volunteers. So it's really seeing themselves in the mathematics and knowing, wait a minute, this is so outside the textbook. We are out, we're doing it, we're moving around, we're having a good time, our teachers are involved, and really connecting with even the higher level mathematics that they probably didn't even know. Because when I said Pythagorean theorem, they were like, oh, I'm not gonna be able to do that. And I'm like, yeah, you will, watch this. Yeah, we're about to have some fun.
Yeah, so you were able to deconstruct it and give them an experience. Yeah, that's so important.
So then how do we challenge our students to be multilingual in mathematics if we're saying mathematics is a language? Because I feel like in a lot of ways, what happens is you're only allowed to, you know, speak mathematics in one particular way. I think about other areas like English, you know, and the ways that people improvise with what even counts as text, right? So it's the world is text. And there's, you know, cereal boxes are text and graphic novels are text. Mm-hmm. And there's not this sense that like there's only one way that it can be represented. And I feel like, where are we in mathematics in being able to represent that kind of multilingualicity, or our ability to be multilingual? And to think about improvisation. Like, language is always improvised, right? We come up with swear words, we come up with slang, mm-hmm. we come up with, there's always ways in which the, you know, English language or any language is kind of adding to it. And I feel like, you know, that's one thing I don't feel like we do a very good job in school, is helping students play with the language. Like, it's one thing to learn the language. It's kind of like, you know, dancers and how dancers learn, you know, maybe they learn classical ballet, but it's like, but then they learn all other kinds of genres. And then there's like an input, there's fusion of things. And I feel like that's something that we really need to get students to see. How do we get them to break those rules of the language so that it's not just, you have to follow them, things that have come before you?
I love that, because you have it here in the introduction to the book. Moreover, understanding mathematics as arising from individuals breaking rules can be powerful incentive forms of teaching. And you're right. Math is all about rules and one way. How could we open that up to make it, to how could kids become mathematic rule breakers?
I think it's just really the practitioner in the room. You know, we tend, and I see it or have seen it across my career. It seems like something with math, teachers teach math how they were taught sometimes. Like, you have to give yourself permission to say, to be outside that box and to say, hey, if you can't do, you know, this strategy, can you draw it for me? Can you talk it out? Can we do something? Can you use the concrete version? But I think it's also getting teachers, giving them permission to accept math in different types of ways. It's not, I will definitely say in the last 5 years, it got so far away from the answer, and let's talk about the process of getting there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the solution, that's right. We can say, yes, that's right, that's wrong. But really, tell me your process and tell me. I want us to spend a lot of time on that. And hopefully in that process, I always look for that student that was doing it differently than what the traditional way. Because even I learned from that. I was like, hey, explain a little bit more to me. That. And that takes, as a teacher, that takes, you're vulnerable then, because you're learning then. Learning from maybe an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old. So that takes, you know, you kind of putting your ego on the shelf and you're really being that student in that seat.
Actually, math allowed us to break the rules. And yeah, I agree with that. It allowed us to do that. But from which point and from which, from where? because every language, you know, they need some certain grammar to carry on. Yep. They need syntax to carry on.
Yep.
If you will allow them to break like as they wish without any basic or basis to start from, then it's going to confuse everyone. So we need a certain, like, you know, to work on like alphabetical orders of mathematics, something like that, other languages. So what is different, basic difference I see, why it is global and different from the other languages, you know, people feel that I can't express my emotion in mathematics. Mm-hmm. I can't be poetic. I can't mm-hmm. sing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, we haven't worked in that area, that I believe that we haven't worked yet. So suppose English language. So English language, French or any other language, Hindi evolved over the years or centuries in a certain place and certain areas. Mm-hmm. So, and within some sort of societies. And after that, in communication time, like now, mobile, TV and everything, the languages are traveling and they're adapting other words from other languages and mm-hmm. becoming richer and richer, right? Mm-hmm. So they're evolving. They are not same they were before 100 years or 200 years back. So the same way, we cannot rule out that the mathematics won't be mathematics will be restricted like that and based on very strict and only for mathematicians or mathematic people, those who know mathematics. It can be for common people, and we have to like work together. And mathematics has been actually evolved across the globe. That's why it's known as global, we say confidently. How it has been evolved like that, I will give you an example for zero. So we saw zero, first of all, in Mesopotamia sometime in BC, and then in 5th century, half of the 5th century in India, then it traveled to Cambodia, then Arabic countries, and now we can see zero as it is. So it has evolved. Mm-hmm. So everyone has right to see that zero is mine. So it's a global. It's not like English or French or something at one place. It has been. Like I can give another example for Euler's number, you know, Euler's number. So actually they have studied Euler's number from compound interest to this E, simple E, for like 150 years from John Napier to Euler until Euler in 1750. So in Scotland and if I know correctly, Swiss, Euler is from Swiss, Switzerland. So you know that this is many countries they studied, and then what math we are seeing is truly global. We have to organize it. So it is like different from other languages. Other languages evolving, I repeat, at the same one place. Math is evolving from every place, and we have mm-hmm. to bring everything together. And yeah, so we can't rule out that it cannot replace other language in the world.
Yeah, and I...
Go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like when you were talking about zero and everything, it just reminds me, like, you can't rush the learning process. So mm-hmm. something like even when the kids are little and they're learning addition, like, yeah, okay, if they can add 7 plus 5, you know, they know the answer. But do they know that when you switch the numbers, you get the same answer, which is the beginning of the associative property, right? Those little things are so important, but we get stuck, I feel, sometimes in like, okay, they know the answer, they know how to do it, we're done. But do they really understand it, you know, at the level that they should? Because just think of that on that foundation that they would get then, think of how that would help them with algebra and then everything else. So it really just starts from that early age of ensuring that they really get it and we're not just kind of pushing them through.
It's about understanding it.
Yeah.
But I want to pick up on that, Nicole, because I think that it's about the understanding, but I also heard you saying we were kind of rushing to have a kind of generalization before there was any kind of meaning that's made about mm-hmm. that generalization, right? And so I think about, you know, when kids are very little, they learn pretty early on that they shouldn't count on their fingers. So you ask little kids about numbers and they'll put their hands under the table and they'll count under the table. I mean, you see adults still do this, right? Yeah. And for me, what that shows is that we've robbed people of the opportunity to, I mean, if we carry around a set of manipulatives with us on a regular basis, why wouldn't we want to use them? That doesn't mean that we would use them forever, but if we take those away too early, before people have made any association and they've made a connection with their bodies, how can the body be a calculator? How can we be thinking about all of that is embedded in, it's embodied in us. But if we rip that away so early and we expect for people to just, okay, you have the answer, you've done it once, you now know it, and you don't really know it, then it feels like, again, that's where school jumps over to the, you know, 100% answer.
Yeah, like, I mean, just think the fact that if a kid could advocate and say, hey, I need the tense frame or I need the number chart, who, at that point, who cares? If they're going to, if it's going to help them get the answer, that's the point, and that they know that adding is putting together, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, like, thank you. That's a great point.
And we know that, you know, adults aren't going to, there's going to be problems that they get to where you can't, you know, you run out of, you know, manipulatives, you know, you need more things. So you're going to have to learn how do you deal with problems that are going to be more complex. But yeah, it just, for me, it feels so, whenever I see people counting with under a table, it always just makes me feel so sad. Like, oh, what kind of education did we give you that robbed you of your ability to feel like you can connect with your body?
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Well, you know, you can also chat with your teeth, with, you know,
your toes.
Your tongue across your teeth. I remember a kid adding that way because you can't see where his tongue is going to count his teeth. That's a good, that's another set of manipulatives. We actually carry a lot of manipulatives on us. Rochelle, I want you to share a little bit about what you mean in your book by this, and in your work, by this idea of napantla, the space in between, and how that is related to teaching math.
So napantla for me is a really important concept. It talks about metaphysics. So it is a space, a space in between, a space where we can say it's both and neither at the same time. And it comes from metaphysics. It's Aztec, and it comes from metaphysics where we recognize that we are constantly in motion. So we're always, we're never singly in one place. We're always in one place, moving to another place. And so it honors the fact that we're all in relation, and that we, that there's a kind of complexity and to an uncertainty in our worlds. So for me, Nepantla, by saying, there's a both and a neither in everything, it gets us away from, in mathematics, I feel like there's a lot of emphasis on binaries. So something's either even or it's odd. Something's either correct or it's wrong. Something's either, you know, we get into all these like distinctions. And yet when you ask mathematicians, things are a lot, there's a lot of uncertainty in mathematics. We just don't tend to show that to students. And so how does Nepantla help us see the both and neither at the same time? Help us see that things, how can a number be both even and odd, maybe? Like, how could you conceive of it in that way, right? And again, it goes back to, you know, this idea of following rules. If students are conceptualizing things and they think everything is supposed to be neatly defined, which mathematics is not, then I think that they don't end up owning some of that mathematics. They don't see themselves as being able to be authors on mathematics. They don't, when something feels uncertain, they think somehow I'm wrong, this is bad, rather than, maybe I'm onto something. Maybe thinking that we're not in two-dimensional space and that we're actually in three-dimensional space would get me to non-Euclidean geometries, which, you know, maybe somebody who would think, oh no, it's either this thing or this other thing. They would say it's either right or it's wrong. And they would just give up, like, okay, clearly I'm not doing the right thing.
And I got thinking about, could we have students honor Nepantla in the learning process of, I'm not there yet, but I'm in this space between not knowing and knowing where I'm headed with math? Because I feel like children are beaten up every day in school over not getting math right. Kimberly, talk about that.
I agree with you, Nancy. I mean, I would even say, let's talk about that. Let's reflect on that. Students should be able to verbalize their process of their learning. It's okay not to be there yet. And I feel like we are all there at one time or another, that what's our learning target? How do we determine mastery? Sometimes I'm a little fuzzy on that. Like, how do you know, do you have to be 100% masterful on everything? Is 70% masterful? However you, I guess, quantify that mastery. What is masterful? And I think it's okay for students to be a work in progress, to go on to the next thing. We should not constantly wait and say, okay, well, no, we can't go on because you're not ready. Well, you know what? And maybe that next thing and the next step that gets them to, you know, to go further on in their mastery. So I think we've got to be flexible with that. And I think that comes with the experience and really seeing the connections between what we teach and how we teach it, And again, being brave and courageous enough to do things a little bit differently.
Yeah. And when they do master it, oftentimes you see those are the students who, okay, they can do word problems, right? That's like the next level, or they can do more of these problems. And then they, I feel like, are the ones that actually miss out on a lot of the visuals and manipulatives. Mm-hmm. And then it's the students who need help are really getting that. But isn't it powerful for all of them to really be exposed to the inquiry and the tactile and all of that, and giving them the option to really explore that further?
Yeah. Yes. So Rachel mentioned inquiry. So, you know, so if you want to, like she's saying, like this, we should not stop them. Okay, you don't know and you do not understand this, so you should not go in next stage to learn the math. So that's, we can like come out of that idea of mathematics to giving them grade and that stays. I totally agree. So how we do that actually? We don't grade them like, oh, you solve, multiply, you found the square root, then you are no mathematics. We are stopping gradually that. We are working on that actually as a teacher. So we give them a broader, stimulation to come up with their ideas. So we don't say in classes, oh, I'm going to teach you today, and this is formula written on the board, memorized, and you are going to solve these many questions next test. No. So we just create some stimulation. I was teaching in grade 11 HL math, higher level, and there was a topic called mathematical induction. And it was very hard to teach because it's very abstract. Like, you know, you prove for one, then you prove for n, and then you prove for n plus one. Mm-hmm. And the students were really like memorizing rules of induction method. So I tried and I tried. You can see that video happening on my Twitter handle, like, you know. So I created a task inquiry. I did not say what I was going to teach. And I asked them, okay, you have a task like you are going to buy a ticket in a cinema hall. And your number is suppose 10. First person is there at the booking and 5% behind you. And suppose there is no any other conditions. I mean, rule out or any other things happening, like someone came in the line and someone went out of the line, just 15 people, your position is 10. How will you say mathematically that you got the ticket? So mathematically, don't say, nine people before me, they got and then I got it. That's literal. Like literally you can say that, okay. How will you say mathematically using logic? So there was no numbers. There was nothing in that task. Mm-hmm. They had to think something like in sequence and create some logic. And say they were higher level students. I'm not saying about kids like of 3 or 4 grades. This is for like age group of 15 and above, 15 to 18. And it was very simple to understand. At the end of the period, they were able to understand clearly that what was induction. So I said, conclusion was the first person got the ticket means sale of ticket starts. Simple logic.
Yeah.
First thing, right. So first person has to get that. And our mathematics book says prove n equals 1, 2. If there are n number of things, then n equals 1 equals 2. So how n equals 1 is true? Because first person has got the ticket. So process starts. Then only I will get number 1. Number 2, okay, I got the ticket. I will confirm when person behind me got the ticket, if nothing happened in this week. So now I got the ticket when a person behind me has certainly got the ticket, then certainly I have got it. So 1, my position is N, and person behind me position is N plus 1. So these 3 makes the statement true that things are, that ticket selling is going on. So this way, math, we are changing approaches to tell them things directly from textbook. We are saying it different way, inquiry way. So we create, it's a hard work, but one inquiry takes like 2 blocks, 3 blocks to go ahead, but they will come. We divide them into the group. So so in this case, I can grade easily. I don't see numbers or I'm not looking for equations to be solved in my class. I'm looking for like, oh, how did you understand? How are you saying? So there were several answers, like, you know, so I divided class into the 4 groups and I graded them well in that period. Okay, you understood, you arrived to that, I got the ticket. You arrive on this stage that the first person has got the ticket. You are thinking in line, so you got this much. You are doing well. So we can transform all these numbers, equations, first of all, into daily life engagements and some natural examples, and that make interesting this lesson. So actually, yeah, that's good. We cannot grade Kimberly at that, say that, oh, you don't know, you don't go in next grade. Right. Yeah.
Well, can we maybe have students start keeping Nepantla journals?
Journals.
Mm-hmm.
What's the mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a thought, but it's time for me to take a pause and thank International Broadcast Media Television for sponsoring this show, because we have so much fun. I love this show. I love the opportunity it's given me to connect with so many people around the world. And that means it is time for What's in Your Mug? So live audience, tell us what you're drinking tonight. Now, I decided to choose a mathematical mug.
Oh, that's cool.
Student's answer on a test there.
Speaking of Pythagorean theorem, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
And I think awesome. It points out how important words can be in math. Perhaps the teacher should have said, find the value of X, but whatever.
Smart.
I'm drinking, as you may know, my live audience may know, that one of my favorite decafs is McDonald's. That's what I have in my mug. Kimberly, what's in your mug?
All right. Well, I have my handy dandy Capricorn mug here. I would say astrology is kind of a thing I got from my mom, but I do believe in the energy, the planets. I am very interested in that. So I got my Capricorn because I'm a Capricorn. So we are funny, ambitious, and reliable. And I have a little simply tropical juice, just juice this evening. Yeah.
Nice. Just juice. Okay. Manish, what's going on over there in Thailand?
I have a simple cup, and wherever we are, we take Indian tea mostly. I love coffees as well, cappuccino, but this time it's a tea, milk tea. With milk and sugar, little bit sugar. I'm using my mug. Why this is important for me, and I love this mug, actually. I'm using this for like 3.5 years. I never get rid of this mug. Why, you know? In first block, if I have some tea or coffee into this, and after one or two sip, I always forget that I had tea or coffee, and I started teaching and forget. So after one or two block, it's a mug as well as a little bit thermos flask.
Very
so it keeps drink hard, so I love this. Small, easy to carry and move along the glass, so I love this.
So you're saying that's an essential tool for a teacher?
For me, at least. For me, it is.
For me, it is. The day,
definitely.
Your beverage still warm.
Yes, that's why I love this cup, and I never get rid of it. I truly
so what is in your mug?
So I am a yoga junkie. That and healthy food and dark chocolate. What is in my mug? My mug has ginger tea. So I love yogi tea. If you don't know of yogi teas, they give you every tea bag has these little sayings that they. This was today's, and I cut them out and I put them on my. I cut them and I put them on my screensaver. I mean, on my cover on my camera, so that they're always like little announcements to me about things that are important. And they always have these very beautiful sayings. And so they're kind of affirmations for me every time I open up my computer to be able to see those and to remember that I'm connected to other people. That's what yoga is about anyhow, is that, you know, you see the light in others and others see the light in you. So I'm drinking my ginger tea.
Wonderful. And I see our folks at home are drinking lots of good stuff too. What was that I saw that went by, that Erica Kapoor is drinking? Cardamom condensed milk latte.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, what is in your mug?
So I have a mug that my oldest daughter made
me.
Put
that a little closer to the camera.
Oh yeah, there you go. Right, over here. To the moon and back. I love you to the moon and back. That's what we say to each other. And in my mug, I have lavender lemon tea. Mm-hmm. I had to cut off the coffee because it's getting a little late, you know. I want to be able to sleep at some point.
I know. I love, high test coffee, but I can't drink it now or I'll be up all night.
And, yes.
You know, then I start texting and calling my friends. So. All right, we are good. So just watching a few more things that our audience at home is drinking, and Tanya is ordering yogi tea now. Okay, and Sabrina, you need to get your daughter a mug. You just asked why she doesn't have a mug. Everybody should have a mug, don't you think? Mm-hmm. All right, let's kick off the second half of our conversation. Nick, want to throw out a question?
Yeah, so we've been talking about just how we, you know, make math of more of a language. So what are some suggestions you have for the educators that are watching, some things maybe that they can do right away, possibly, in their classrooms to help shift this process?
So, yeah.
We're right now in that Napantla.
Yeah.
So, well, so you know,
that's wait time. We like.
I told previously, math definitely is a language, but it's not going to happen very recent or in fast pace. It takes time, and it happens over, like, you know, it may take decades or centuries to happen, but we have to keep working to in that direction. So, I had a math book in Thai language, and I saw first two, three pages. I went through that, and I couldn't understand any Thai. I don't know Thai, so I didn't understand any Thai word into that math book. But, you know, I was able to understand clearly what was mathematics into that. So what happens? They were using X and Y, even though it was in Thai, they were using X, Y, and, you know, Y equals MX plus B, those equations. So I was able to figure out what they're trying to say into that. So actually, I understood that language. And the story behind that mathematics they solved, I was able to, like, you know, think about that. What would have been that story question? Maybe different story with local heroes or someone else, but story I was able to understand clearly. So actually, it's a mathematics is turning into a language gradually, and it's happening. It's happening. We have to simplify it. We have to work on it and make it more easier to like to send it or to useful for the common people, those who are not in mathematical field. I never suggest that think only among the mathematical community. We understand. We know it is a language. We don't debate it. So it's a debate. I believe that for people, those who are out of this context, like if someone is in farming, someone is working in a MACD or something since start and haven't come across a very complicated math, but the simple math, 2 + 2, everyone does, right? So everyone does in that, in, you know, her, his life every time. So suppose a farmer or like in farming also they use, like they measure their land, they weigh their crops and they make profit and loss. They have to keep some account in their mind. And that much language is enough to transform, like, you know, mathematics to make them understand. Mm-hmm. So if they do know that much mathematics. So it's happening, I believe. So I can give example from, in Hindi, we say, 9 to 11 hona. 9 to 11 hona, 9 to 11 means cut and run in English. And if I assume I say my student in that language, they understand easily what my teacher is saying in these mathematical numbers. So actually in every sort of society, I believe if I have something like that, maybe a Chinese community has something like that, Thai community, English community, and in South America, they have something. We have to work together and bring all those things. So another thing, like, yeah, so that it will take a shape, like rules and grammar, and then it is there, but my focus is how I will involve common people into this, those who are not directly from mathematics.
That is so important.
It just
reminds me when I was teaching, and Nancy had said, you know, I taught middle school math. I had two of the most phenomenal co-teachers with me. I just had a really great experience with my co-teachers. And one of the things we used to ask each other together, if we didn't understand math, how could we break this down, or what visual could we provide? You know, what could we do so that it would make sense to someone who had no clue what we were talking about? And we used to meet like 2 times a week and just strategize. And it helped us so much. We came up with so many creative ideas just by kind of thinking through that process.
Kimberly, what do you think?
Primitive language, you know, primitive language, they use lines and drawings, some pictures, you know. So still we understand. We are using in mathematics called statistics, you know. We know that tally mark, pictorial representation. Even they don't know any number or calculation or any math, they can understand it easily by pictures and the lines. Still it's happening. Sorry to interrupt you, Kimberly. Can you
start? No, you're fine. No. I would say even teachers, parents, families. I mean, take a little bit of time every day and have a number talk. Take a number walk. You know what I mean? Like I don't think we really understand math is all around us. I remember being younger and just being in stores with my mom, and she always used to say, okay, I buy you that shirt if you can figure out the percentage off in your head. And that's how, you know what I mean? But really what she was doing, I don't know if she knew, was it unconsciously, but she was that number sense and that, you know, when is two, maybe not exactly two, or two may not look like two all the time. Two may be 10 over five. It may be 8/4. You know, like we have to become comfortable with the numbers. We got to take that fear and that anxiety away from it. So just simple number talks. And that's what even teachers can start their days off every day. And, you know, you can find them online. They're really easy, but just get the kids talking about the mathematics. And the more they talk to one another and the more they get their brain and coming familiar with numbers, it is amazing, you know, what could happen. It really is.
So your mom was savvy.
Yes, savvy she was. Yes,
and
yes.
The number, the
and hopefully talk. She's watching now. So you heard that, Mom. Nicole said, you are savvy.
Shout out to Kimberly's mom.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I was brought into work in a school, middle school. They had study done of a, you know, I guess they had different groups, critical friends from other districts that would come in. Mm-hmm. They had a study done and they really criticized them and their math program. And we were coming in to design learner active technology infused classrooms. And so I wanted to get my background here on the math department. And I read the study. And one of the things they didn't like was that, now, Rochelle, you're not going to like to hear this, was that as they asked, as they interviewed the teachers, the teachers kept saying they wanted the students to feel the joy of math. And in the report, they wrote like the joy of math, the joy of math. Like it isn't about the joy of math. And then I was like, well, they need to read this book, you see, because it says right here that we need to rehumanize math and it conjures up feelings of joy. So talk to us a little bit more, Rochelle, about the rehumanizing of math.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now we present mathematics in school as a very utilitarian tool. We say it's going to help you be a problem solver in life. It's going to help you get a STEM-based career. It's going to help you not get, you know, cheated at, you know, if you're purchasing a car or thinking about something that you're going to have to think about compound interest or something. Or it's going to help you be a critical thinker. And we never really think of, so it's always like a means to an end. It's never an end. There's never a sense that like, well, you would just do this thing because it's fun or because it's playful or because it brings you joy or because there's some aesthetic value to it. So, you know, when I was talking about those murmurations of starlings, there's something very mathematical about what starlings are doing in terms of only paying attention to the closest six birds around them, right? And there's a joy to that. And there's kind of a teaching that's available in that. And so when we kind of present mathematics as always this utilitarian tool, we strip it of students being able to see how there could be something joyful in that work. And I think when I think about one of the moves I think that's important for us to make is right now, I feel like mathematics needs a fuel source. And right now I think the fuel source is fear. I think people do mathematics a lot of times out of fear. They're fearful that they're not going to make it to that honors class. They're fearful that they're not going to get into college or be able to get into a calculus. They're fearful that they're not going to make the get a job that will earn them a certain amount of money. They're fearful that they won't make a high status job. They're fearful that, and fear also keeps people from doing mathematics. But many of the people who are learning mathematics are often at those early ages, not learning it just because it's joyful. They're learning it because it's like, they don't want to miss out. They don't want to be, they don't want to look dumb. They don't want to. And that's a very different thing than thinking about a mathematics where we could say, what if mathematics helped us reattach to each other as humans? What if it helped us reattach to land and to waters? What if part of mathematics was seeing pattern so that we could see how we see ourselves in plants? We see plants in us. We see ourselves in land. We see land in us. We see how all of us are just interconnected. That's a very different reason why we would want to learn or pay attention to mathematical patterns. I'm not sure if that answered your question about joy. But For me, that's part of the joy, because being able to say like, wow, those fractal patterns in trees are the same fractal patterns in my lung system, or, oh, those, whatever. I mean, we're all, there's something very joyful about being able to recognize pattern and see that pattern in ourselves and in others. And that, again, that brings us together in a connected way. That's not just a utilitarian, like, this is going to help me solve problems. So I'm going to have to learn how to, I'm going to have to strengthen this muscle, which I hear a lot of teachers kind of saying.
Yeah, and fractals are so important. And yet I think, I remember I was working with a group of eighth grade teachers and their students didn't do well on the state test in fractals. And they were like, we don't even know what fractals are. So I was like, you know, it's kind of that issue of, we have, you know, been taught that math, as you said, it's the numbers, it's the rules, it's putting it together. And we're not expanding that sense of mathematics is a much bigger art and science. Then I used to say all the time, math is not a science, it's an art. And people would look at me like I was crazy. And even when I became a computer programmer, and I thought it was always interesting that computer programmers will always talk about an elegant solution. And isn't it beautiful? And people would say, beautiful. It's like, it's numbers, it's code. And it's like, no, it's an art. It's an art of putting the world, you know, seeing the world as one holistic view, because you understand math. And I think that's where we need to be headed with mathematics instruction.
So most of the time our students used to ask why we are studying this math. So I was teaching trigonometry, sine, cos, and tangent. So they say, oh, why you are teaching this? Are we going to use? And I want economics in college. Why should I study this? So sometimes they argue on that point and they're right. So I said, okay, you are yet to be judged what you are going to be in your life. So until like 12 or 10, there is education, we have education system. So you know a little bit about everything, then you decide about your career path. So if you don't know anything about something and you want to decide about your career, you are just missing some part of your life completely. So you won't be able to explore that area that you can be a mathematician or computer programmer. So you need to know basic at least. That's why school is teaching all these topics. And actually at this stage, school stage, we are not able to connect or sine and cos and log and then Euler's and all those together, how they will come together. So you are studying in isolation. So sometimes it feels always useless for you, but not. It's not useless. You are building up to decide about your career for college. So if you don't know, yeah. So next thing is making this, taking them out of fear of mathematics. Best thing I believe firmly that take them out of the classroom. It's not in board or chalk or something, teaching all the time and lecturing to them, oh, this is math, learn, you will pass the test. We have to take them to out of the class. And I believe most of the schools are, and school heads and principals are very happy to support us in that way. They do. They love this one. And when we take out and we see natural things and we ask them, what do you observe and how you will transform into what I said at the start of the conversation, how you will transform this. So fear goes. They say, oh, yes, I want to. I can use it some point of time in my life. Not now, but I can, because it is from nature. And beauty actually comes from mathematics. If you want something beautiful, first is symmetry. If something is not symmetrical, you don't see any beauty, actually.
I'm going to argue against that. I'm going to fiercely argue against that. Yeah. Because I think that we teach people that symmetry is what matters, what's important, but asymmetry is important in the biological world. We have to have asymmetry for protein folding. If we have like a tree that's perfectly symmetrical, it actually isn't as beautiful to our eye as a tree that has some asymmetry to it, just like our faces, right? So I'm going to make that argument against you, Manish, because I feel like we tell our students symmetry is so important, and I'm like, so is asymmetry.
I used to own an abstract art gallery of abstract expressionists, and of course, there's nothing symmetrical about abstract expressionism. It's the most amazing, to me, the most amazing art form, and it's the beauty is in all of that.
The imperfection, right?
It's exactly.
In the imperfection and.
And Nancy, can I add one thing to, I would say the beauty the beauty is in the process. Like, even if there's a mistake at the end, as Rochelle was saying, it's just the imperfection sometimes of mathematics is there. The beauty, that's where the beauty is. I mean, even if I'm just saying, for example, if a kid is solving the quadratic, you know, a quadratic equation, and they're plugging in all those and substituting all those numbers, it still looks great on paper to me, even if you get to the end and your roots are right. You know what I mean? Like, it's okay. So let's go back and let's look. So the beauty is in the mistakes. The beauty is in the process. The beauty is in the different methods in which you get there, the different strategies that you use. And that's what makes, I mean, look at all of us. We're coming from all different, you know, venue and types, and we got here tonight by different ways. So I think that's beautiful.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Someone in the live audience had written a while back, so I don't know if you'll find it, director, but they talked about the errors, you know, kind of the power of looking at the mistakes, the power of that's okay, you know, to look at what's wrong, what went wrong. And more recently, someone wrote about the fact that, it was Catherine Barpoulis, who was actually on the show in the past, and she talked about the connections to music. When I was a director in a school district, I had taught fourth grade, middle school, high school. I'd never taught the primary grades, and I wanted to feel what it was like. So I remember telling the person who ran, the substitutes, I said, listen, the next time you know you need a substitute for primary grades, please bring me in because I would like to just sub for the day. So we had a second grade teacher who was going out. He knew he was going to be out, so he met with me. And it was funny because he piled up these textbooks. And he said, well, first you'll do this, you know, and then we're going to do this. And then you're going to do this, and you're going to do this. And then there's this worksheet on adjectives and this. And of course, y'all know how I think, like none of that was going to fly. So I was like, yeah, we'll get to the same end. So I brought in for all of these. So how old are you in second grade? Seven?
Eight, nine.
And I brought in all of these different food types, and the kids had to taste them and then write about how they thought it tasted. And so they're tasting like lemons and writing about how they think it tastes. And then I gave them, I guess it was chicory. And then I taught them how to politely spit something out that you don't know. It was very cute. And we did this whole thing on adjectives. And then they had to learn like the beginning, the basics of fractions. So I pull out my guitar and I start playing songs and I'm having them singing with me. And then I'm teaching them what a whole note is and a quarter note and a half note. And, you know, we did this whole thing on fractions. And in the end, it was really funny because the person who was in charge of substitutes, she called me up and she goes, I just want you to know your name has been put on a list never to allow you to substitute in the primary grades again because none of the kids want to go back to their teachers.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, isn't that what it's about?
It's so important. They don't even know they're learning and they are learning. Yeah. And that's I think the whole, even what Rochelle was saying about dehumanizing, right, is just making it just a joyful experience and making it, happy.
Yeah. Even though I broke the cardinal rule of substitute teaching.
And you taught them to spit politely. But
change teachers' classrooms. All right. Give us another nugget from the mathematical world. Who wants to share something that you want to make sure you say? Because we only have 1 minute left.
I want to say, I feel sometimes like when we say these things about how math should change, we make it seem as if teachers alone are going to be able to do this. Like if teachers would just do this stuff, then it'll just happen in classrooms. But, you know, we know the politics of schooling. We understand how corporate America is invested. We understand how certain families benefit from the system staying the same with tracking and things like that. And so I feel like I don't want us to leave the show without talking a bit about the politics of schooling and of teaching and what we're dealing with in our nation right now, because I think mathematics is not separate from Black Lives Matter. It's not separate from, you know, the climate change that we're dealing with. It's not separate. And we have an invitation right now to really not go back to normal in mathematics. And I feel like in a lot of ways, you know, systems are, you know, protecting the old way of doing things. And so I don't want to leave with any teacher feeling like we're saying you should just do these things differently in your classroom, because I think a lot of teachers would be on board with what we're saying. But it's like, how do I do this? And where do I fit this in when I'm asked to cover all this, when I've got strict pacing guides, when I've got surveillance, when I've got, you know, all these other things that are going on in my school.
Yeah, we need big change at the policy level. We need, and we need the world to think differently. So I think we're going to need another show.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more to, you know, to pull out of this book. I would like to say, I want to give you a shout out, Rochelle, because I love that you say in here, even though in the case of the cover, it says rehumanizing mathematics for Black, Indigenous, and Latinx students. You then throughout the book say, I'm going to keep mixing those up so that you honor all. And I don't want anybody to turn it into Bill, Black, Indigenous, Latinx. So the next sentence you read, and she has Indigenous, Latinx, and Black. And then the next sentence you read, and it's Latinx and Black. And that is such a thoughtful nuance that most people wouldn't even think to do. So I want to thank you for that. And unfortunately, we could go on for hours, and perhaps we're going to need a second show on this to dive deeper into that level. But I would like to thank Nicole, my co-host tonight. I would like to thank Nish and Kimberly and Rochelle for being here as my guests.
Thank you for having
me. I hope you agree to come back. So thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take you guys backstage, and I'll be there soon. And I want to thank the live audience. You guys keep the conversation lively. I love all of the points that you put in there. So thanks for coming back week after week. I really appreciate it. And again, to Ankit and Nick and Kim, who are the executive producers of the show in International Broadcast Media TV, and Gwen Fan, who is our executive director behind the scenes, even though we have our own directors in the company now who have learned from the master, Gwen Fan. And that is Carrie and Boyd, you're with us. So thank you so much for everything that you do. And next week, we are going to have a group of seven women who call themselves the Formers, because they are former. It began with a group of former female assistant superintendents who got together and just started having lunches and conversations, and the group has grown, and you're going to have to see these guys to believe it. So make sure that you come back next week for the Formers. And as always, the kids of IDE are going to take us off the show. So thank you very much. God bless. See you next week.
And I was at school for 100 days. So I'm 100 days smarter.
I go to FIT and I use math and statistics when I analyze large amounts of data to determine buying and selling trends.
I think math is fun because it works your mind.
I go to FIT for visual presentation and exhibition design. I use math for dimensioning large-scale projects and programs such as CAD, and for constructing products like this one.
Hi guys, it's really my birthday today! So we're playing pizza, and it's so much fun, and I'm giving my mommy some pizza. We'll need pizza! Logie, tell them. Okay, pizza. Thank you guys for watching my video. Bye!
For now, I've taken multivariable calculus and am currently in differential equations. While not very useful in daily life, both classes are very useful for engineers modeling real-world situations.
Thanks for watching Learning Unwrapped. Tune in next week to talk about the Formers.